This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Body Bags with Joseph Scott Moore. When people meet me many times that have heard me on a podcast or seen me on television, one of the first questions they ask, or one of the first comments they make, is I cannot begin to understand how you did for a living what you did for so long. And it always comes back around to the fact that I essentially lived with the dead. Now, yeah, I understand. I'm a forensics guy, and I'd go out and I work cases. I interacted with my colleagues. But I got to tell you, there were many weeks when I literally spent more time with dead folks than I did with living folks. And there were many times in my life I preferred being around the dead. They generally don't give you any issues at all. There's no surprises with them most of the time. I mean, yeah, you'll find pathology. But, you know, the dead are dead. And the living going about their lives. But every now and then, there's a case that occurs where the living and the dead just can't seem to go their separate ways. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags. Dave, I'm thinking back in time right now. And I wrote about in my memoir, I wrote a story about a case that I'd worked many, many years ago that I spent a protracted period of time with literally a refrigerator truckload full of dead bodies from a capsized vessel. And we were real busy that summer when that happened. And so just because you have a major loss of life incident in a medical examiner or coroner's office, does not mean that the everyday other cases stop coming in. It's kind of like, and I wouldn't presume to necessarily compare myself literally to my colleagues that worked 9/11 at the OCME in New York, but you have to understand, yeah, the Twin Towers collapsed, the other buildings collapsed, you had thousands of dead, but Dave, homicides didn't stop. You know, you didn't have fatal events that just ceased because that one moment in time we had a major loss of life. Things happen, and sometimes you get stacked up with the dead. And in a way, you become numb to it, I think. The dead, and I mean no disrespect by this, but the dead just, they're part and parcel of your daily existence. When I would walk into a room, into the autopsy room, for instance, and I would have somebody literally with their head blown apart, then next to them on another table would be a horribly decomposed body. And then you might have a grandma that just passed away in her sleep, and they're all lined up on the table. I didn't pay any more attention to that in A Man in the Moon. I mean, you get numb to it when you're going through it. It doesn't mean that you're not paying attention to detail, but there's this thing that comes about where as part of your occupation and part of what you do, you're able to create this kind of weird membrane that kind of buffets any kind of trauma you might have. What's really odd is that when people that are not used to being around the dead suddenly insert themselves into an environment where they not only are around the dead for a period of time, but they might live with dead bodies for a protracted period of time. And it took me a long time professionally to build up that callus. And it is a callus. It's like swinging a hammer. You know, you get to the point where it doesn't impact you the way that it did when you first started. But for somebody just to indwell a residence, a structure with dead bodies and not think anything of it, it's kind of odd. What say you, my friend?
One of the first questions I had about the story, Joe, is we're going to talk about Nikki Kassop. And he is 17 years old, and he is accused of killing his mother and his stepfather and staying with their bodies, their dead bodies, for at least 10 days, probably longer than that, maybe 15 days. It could be somewhere, but a week and a half to 2 weeks worth of time, this 17-year-old person stayed in the home with two dead bodies. And we're not talking about people that he just saw in a battlefield. You know, we're talking about his mother and stepfather. Yep. We're talking about people he has a long relationship with that he allegedly took their lives for whatever reason. We still don't have a true motive here, but he actually was cohabitating. He was sleeping, eating in this house with both of these bodies. That's why we're doing body bags on this episode, on this particular story, because we don't know what was going on in this person's life that brought him to the, it wasn't just enough to kill and leave, which we see that a lot. You know, we see people kill and get rid of a body. You know, that's where we catch them, getting rid of the body. Not here. You've got a kid who never missed school, Joe. And one of the ways he got caught, well, he didn't show up for 2 weeks. The school was concerned. School resource officer reaches out. You know, that's where this kind of came from, is, and of course, his stepfather's mother. She hadn't talked to her son, and she was concerned as well. So you had two different calls for a well-being check.
Which, there's that term again.
I know. Isn't it? It's so weird because they don't used to call it a welfare check, but because of people getting a welfare check, they don't call it welfare check. Now it's well-being check.
But yeah, no, so they actually did change the verbiage for that purpose.
Yeah.
And because, I found that so odd.
I
so
know. Very odd. It's like, you know what? When President Ronald Reagan was shot by Hinckley back in 1981. Yeah. March of 81. Okay. The Gilligan's Island franchise had become a movie of the week kind of thing, where they were doing a return from Gilligan's Island, escape from Gilligan's Island, like Battle of the Apes. But from the very first episode, when they announced the names of all of these passengers on the SS Minnow, they gave you the name of the professor. His name was Professor Roy Hinckley. When John Hinckley tried to kill Ronald Reagan for the next, I don't know, Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island or whatever it was, they changed the name of the professor to Hinkle.
For that reason.
For that very reason.
Yeah.
And I think about that when these things come up. So instead of saying it's a well-being, we're checking on their well-being.
Right. It's no longer a welfare check. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the verbiage changes, you know, day in and day out. And it's everybody likes to engineer language. But, you know, the one thing you can't engineer is outcomes, I think, relative to the consequences of living with a dead body. And I was thinking, you know, you and I both, and please, you know, don't misconstrue what I'm saying here. I am not comparing our sons to this individual. What I'm doing is comparing teenage boys. You and I both have had the adventure of living in a household raising teenage boys, and teenage boys do really stupid things.
Not the most thoughtful people in the world.
Yeah, they're not. And I were one at one point in time, and I do remember doing really stupid things. And I got to thinking about this kid who is actually living in this environment with these two individuals, one of whom is his own mother, the other his stepfather. And I'm thinking, did he have like a brain freeze, you know, at that moment in time where it's like, I have done this and now I don't know where to go. And I really wonder many times if, and it's not, that doesn't necessarily just apply to teenage boys. I think it applies to a lot of perpetrators out there, because we see it, Dave. I mean, you know, every week we cover cases and we see these individuals that make really stupid, you know, mistakes along the way, if you want to call it a mistake. It's not like they're filing their taxes and they've, you know, misentered something. It's actually a, they didn't think the process through, I think. And it's really easy. You know, I think that when you react, and all of us have reacted in anger to things many times. I know I have. I'm chief amongst sinners. And then you go back, you have a quiet moment or two, and you sit back and you shake your head and you say, I'm such an idiot. Why did I say that? Why did I do that? I know that there are going to be consequences for this, and I'm just going to have to sit down and take it, you know? And I wonder many times about these individuals that perpetrate crimes, and they just kind of freeze, and they can't move beyond that to make some better decision about how they're going to handle something.
Yeah. You know, Joe, the headline on this story, I was looking at several, because a 17-year-old killing his mother and stepfather that's a big deal. That's a big story. But the headlines on this one, it's Wisconsin teen killed mother and stepfather and lived with ... Teen lived with bodies of mom and stepfather after killing them ... Teen killed mom and stepdad, then lived with bodies for ... It's all about, and this one, I love this one. Teen charged with killing parents lived with rotting corpses ... That's what we're actually doing today, is getting to the most explosive ending. It's not bad enough that the guy killed his parents at 17 years old. But now the real headline, the real shock, is he didn't get rid of the bodies. He didn't chop them up and try to get rid of them like so many we've had recently. He's got two dead bodies in different parts of the house, Joe. And basically he threw blankets over the top of them. So I'm wondering and I know we'll get to this.
Right.
But how long does it take before the bodies start to decompose and give off this odor of death? And that's what this 17-year-old is living with. I can't imagine that it's going to be a pleasant thing to live in.
By the end of day two, he would have had an odor in the air. I can almost guarantee that. So you're talking about, if that's the case, if that's our benchmark for starting from, I'm not talking about the appearance of postmortem changes and decompositional changes. I'm talking about that smell. It's like a phantom that comes out of the dark and kind of slaps you in the face the first time you smell it. We would be talking about the lion's share of the time that he was living in this home, he would have smelt this. And he made no effort to take them out into the yard or dispose of them in the basement or even remove them to the attic. Do you remember the case that we had, which, by the way, that reminds me, do a follow-up on this, the case from was it in Grosse Pointe? It was in Detroit, of the wealthy surgeon that was found wrapped up in his attic. Do you remember that case? And he had been killed. Gosh. And they have arrested somebody with that. But, you know, even in that case, the perpetrator, to the best of my knowledge, didn't hang around, but they still wrapped the body up, took the body into a sequestered area in the attic and put him up there. Well, that guy would have been smelling, you know, pretty quickly. These bodies, and particularly the mother, and we can dive into this a little bit more, but the mother had multiple layers placed upon her. And we've talked about this before. When you layer a body like that, that's essentially like placing an item in a crock pot. It's the heat that's being given off, you know, just as a result, the heat that is generated, and there is a certain amount of heat that is generated from cellular decay, where you have the cells, the actual cells in our bodies begin to break down and kind of leach out. There is a certain amount of heat that is given off in that process. Well, it's further exacerbated by doing these the layers like this. And so the body is slowly kind of rendering down throughout the entire period. And you can actually think of it as almost like a tenderizing moment So the body at a cellular level is that's expedited as a result of this layering of blankets all on top of the body. So when you finally pull back these blankets, it's going to be something that is so disgusting and so insulting to your senses. But, you know, there's a lot to be said about the nature of a scene like this, particularly when you consider that the victims are those individuals that held the title of parents, and how much even more so when one of the victims has been so brutalized at the hands of her son and then left to rot in the floor of their home without any consideration for desecration of her remains. So, Brother Dave, you mentioned that, you know, our favorite term, welfare check, or what's the new term now?
Being check. The well-being
check. Yeah. The well-being. Yeah.
Yeah.
The well-being check had been requested on February the 28th of 2025. And this is actually in Waukesha, Wisconsin. And what kind of prompted this, you know, kind of moving forward?
It was, there were two things. It was a two-pronged thing. One, you have a student who has a perfect record for attendance, and all, and his name is Nikita Kasop. And he goes by the name Nikki. Nikki had perfect attendance, and all of a sudden he misses 2 weeks out of school. That was, from the school standpoint, they're like, hey, something's wrong. And they're trying to call the house. They're not getting anybody on the phone. So finally, the school resource officer, he calls the police and says, we need to do a well-being check. We've got a student. He hasn't been here. We can't get in touch with anybody on our records. Well, at the same time, while that is happening on the 28th of February, the stepfather's mom, Donald Mayer's mother, Dorothy, she actually calls and asks for a well-being check because she hasn't talked to Donald in a couple of weeks. And, oh, I need to add something, and I apologize for missing this.
Hush, that's okay.
There were a couple of instances of odd text messages being received. One in particular was Donald Mayer, the stepfather. His boss, his supervisor at work, had gotten text messages from him during the course of the time leading up to February 28th. And one of them was, I'm still sick, going to need another week. And it wasn't normal for him to text in that manner. And one of the text messages said, I'm sick and I can't talk. So I would call you, but I have to text. I can't talk. So as adults, we know, what are the odds of this happening? You know, this is not something in our lifetime we have ever really heard of. It happens on sitcoms, you know, and things like that, but not in real life. And so that text message was one, and the other one was at the school. So they had some suspicious meanderings going on with these text messages. But either way you look at it, on February 28th, the police show up, and that's when this case hits the media. Because when they first walk in, and Joe, this is something that I've asked you before, and I wonder if there's a difference in communities and towns, counties, states, and things like that on when you're doing a well-being check as an officer. You walk in, you know, you're not getting anybody at the door. You're not getting anybody on the phone.
Right.
And, you know, you're looking for ways to get inside the house, you know, to see in what's going on in there. And when they do, when police do finally get inside, they find a body.
Right.
They don't find a body sitting out in front. What they do is in the garage, they find the mother's BMW is in the garage, but the father's stepfather's VW Atlas is not in the garage. There's no dog. They have a dog named Toby. Toby's not there either. But they do find Miss Kassab. What is her name? I apologize for that. Tatiana. Tatiana Kassab. They find her body in a hallway adjacent to the kitchen, and it's covered in blankets, towels, things like that. And I'm wondering, Joe, when police see that, they have to determine that there's, oh, by the way, when they got there, they could, when they opened the door, they smelled death. Smelled this. And so it's the 28th of February in Wisconsin, and they smelled death. Now, when they walk in, the police find this area in the hallway that it's got clothes and things piled up, blankets and what have you, but there's a body underneath. I'm going to guess you could pretty much tell based on things happening in that general vicinity of a body is there because it's deteriorated enough that they smelled it, right?
Yeah, well, you'd have to confirm, and these are excellent questions, and this is actually the type of thing that we teach at Jack State with my students. And let me just kind of break it down to you this way.
I need you to, because I'm serious. Well, Joe, I've been on scenes where there were bodies and things. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not the officials. I'm there after the fact as a journalist, usually, you know, or a family member. And so I was confused as to what would be the first step. I mean, even if you're the police officer, how far do they have to go? Because do they call you first? Say, I think we got a dead body, or I mean,
well, they will call us. They'll generally call. What will happen is the call will go out. And by the way, Wisconsin is a coroner state, so they still have coroners in Wisconsin. And you know, it is one of those states that still elects a county coroner. And I've met some of them over the years. They're fine people. They go through pretty extensive training. But, you know, it's like anything else in life. You don't know what you're going to get from county to county. But the coroner is somebody that you have to rely on in a set of circumstances like this. What the uniform division would do is that once they determined that they at least have this one body, first off, just because you smell something does not necessarily mean that it is human. Remember you talked about Toby, the missing dog. Well, a dog's going to give off a foul odor too. It would appear that Tatiana, I've seen the images of her. She's not a very big person. Matter of fact, there's one great family image of her with their son and the stepdad, and they're standing there, and you know, both these guys tower over her. You know, she's tiny. So you would have to confirm that you do in fact have a human body. You would do as little as you possibly could to disrupt those layers, because Dave, for every strata of garment, blanket, tablecloth, towel, each one of those has evidentiary value. The reason it does is that if you believe this is a homicide, which remember our working assumption that not some but all deaths until proven otherwise are in fact homicides, each thing that the perpetrator, and you have to assume that it's the perpetrator that covered the bodies, has put their hands on each one of these layers. So each layer has evidentiary value to it. Once the police had and I'm talking about the uniform division, once the uniform division, and hopefully there was a supervisor out there, that supervisor would look at anybody in a uniform in that house, stop what you're doing, turn around, exit out through this door, no other doors, don't touch anything else, pay attention to where you put your feet, be fully aware of your surroundings. Get out of this house. We're shutting the door behind us. We're calling CID, Criminal Investigation Division, Crimes Against Persons. Because not all police departments have a homicide division. The guys that work in Crimes Against Persons will handle rape, assault, ag assault. They'll handle homicides. it all kind of gets lumped in together. You go to a bigger department and they'll have specific homicide investigators, but you're going to call CID and you'll say, get CID en route out here. You'll also say, we're going to have to get forensics en route, which means the crime scene unit is going to come out. And, oh, by the way, get the coroner en route as well. But before any of those people can enter the house, you're going to have to go to a magistrate. The CID, the detective will. They will go to the magistrate that's on duty or the judge, and they'll say, look, we got to get a search warrant. We've got a lady laying in a hallway covered by all manner of clothing and, you know, blankets and everything else. And it looks like we've got a homicide, because you don't want to, you do not want to go into that house and start processing that scene and not have all of your bases covered, because anything that you find in that house that does not have, and I'm talking about absent a warrant, anything you find in that house, like that's in a hidden space, say if you just kind of arbitrarily walk over and open a closet. You can open a closet door if you think there might be a body in there. Maybe you see fluid leaking out from under the door. Maybe it's blood, what you think is blood. You can open the closet. But if you get in that closet and you start digging around and you find some kind of valuable piece of evidence, guess what? Without a warrant, there's a high probability that whatever you find in that closet, it could be a kilo of cocaine, can be excluded. So you have to be very, very careful. That's why, and a lot of people scratch their heads, why do you need a warrant? I mean, this is probably a homicide. That's all the more reason that you want a warrant, because you're going to be backstopped by that legally. And that way you can do, and it's not going to hurt anything for you. If you secure the scene, then there's no harm that's going to come. And there, let me tell you one other thing. In this case, they were able to find mom and they were able to find stepdad, but they couldn't find the dog. They couldn't find the car, and they can't find the son. Well, there's two major parts to this investigation. You've got the bodies in the house, which appear to be homicide, you know, the victims of homicide. And then you've got a son that's vanished and who's 17, by the way. He's a kid, and the car is missing. You don't know that he hasn't been kidnapped. You don't know that, you know, he's being held somewhere. You also don't know if maybe he's a suspect. I mean, for me, being the jaded old investigator I am, he's at the top of the list. I got to tell you that. But your other part of the investigation is find this kid and find him immediately. Because the further away he gets, there's a higher probability that evidence can be destroyed or he might escape capture. He's somebody you do want to talk to. Because he is domiciled at this location. You got two dead bodies and he's missing. And one of the family cars is missing. So you've got to do everything that you can to secure the scene so that CID can get out there and the coroner and everybody. And, oh, the other part to this is you got to track this kid down. And there's no, you don't need a warrant for that necessarily. You don't need a warrant to go to the school and maybe talk to the principal, the counselors, and that would be a separate set of investigators that are going to go out and do that. And you're going to be handling this. There'll be one lead investigator that'll be in charge of everything. And they'll be the point of contact for the DA as well. And they'll kind of overlord the whole investigation. All right. Finding him and understanding what's going on at the scene. And then once you get that kind of steadied, get the ship steadied, then you could begin to process the scene after you get that warrant. Because Dave, this is going to be a highly complex situation that you're walking into, because you have no idea. You've got two decomposing human remains here. You have no idea what the cause of death is. And you've got to kind of narrow that down as quickly as you possibly can. First off, to see if you're actually dealing with a homicide or maybe something different. There's probably no greater iconic figure in motion picture history when it comes to playing the cop against the system than the character of Dirty Harry, played by Clint Eastwood. And he famously said, and I think that it was actually in the first Dirty Harry movie, which is called Dirty Harry, that the 44 Magnum was the most powerful handgun in the world. That's no longer true. There are other ones that are more powerful now, but yet it's still formidable. But it's not really practical. All right, it's a huge weapon. It was never practical for anybody to carry. But one weapon that is not quite as powerful but is revered is 357 Magnum. And 357 Magnum is an interesting weapon in the sense that it is 0.357 caliber in a magnum load, which means that you've got this chunk of lead in the end of a bullet, a live round, and you've got a magnum load of propellant in here. So you've got this thing driving it down the muzzle of this weapon. And when it slams into anybody, it's like being hit with a sledgehammer, very powerful. And interestingly enough, in our case today that we're discussing, Dave, Mr. Mayer, the stepfather of this young man, had recently purchased a 357 Magnum. And guess what? It's missing. It's missing from, not only is the car missing, Toby the dog is missing, the teen is missing, the recently purchased 357 Magnum is missing as well, Dave.
Now, we've got, as we mentioned before, we actually have a little bit of a time frame between the last time anyone recalls hearing from Donald Mayer or Tatiana Kasop and her son attending school. And we also know that when police arrive, they find her body under a bunch of clothing. Now, what they've told us, Joe, is that they've got multiple gunshot wounds to her.
Yeah.
And Donald Mayer was found in an office in the home. By the way, this is a 3,000 square foot home, 4-bedroom, 2.5-bath.
It's big. I get the pictures. I urge anybody out there to go take a look at the pictures.
Beautiful
house. I'm sorry,
I didn't
mean to interrupt you.
No, buddy, beautiful house, nice neighborhood.
Yeah.
And again, you know, the dog is missing, and so is the VW Atlas that is owned by Donald Mayer. Anyway, police get there and they find her in the hallway. That's when they walk back out. Let's get the search warrant. They come back. Now, they know they don't have the son, and they don't have a car, and they don't have a dog. So those things are things they're looking for right now. They find Donald Mayer in his office, in an office in the house, and he's been shot once in the back of the head with that 357 Magnum. Well, I don't know how soon they figured that out, but based on the wound as it's described. But as they're trying to figure everything out, Joe, and I asked you early on about the smell. How long would it take before the smell hit? Because we are dealing with a number of days here between the time that the police believe the killings took place and the day the bodies were found. But we have a 17-year-old who is not in the home dead. Car's missing, dog's missing. And so they put out, they're doing they're on scene at the house. They're examining the bodies. And we got to find this kid. Find that car. Look for this kid. Find the dog. So anymore, we have these license plate readers. They're everywhere. We got surveillance cameras. They're everywhere. It's amazing. If you haven't kept up with the times, friends, you are being tracked all day, every day. Yep. They were able to find Nikki, and he was not near home. They found Nikki the same day they found the bodies, Joe. they find Nikki 850 miles away from home the same day they find the bodies. They find him at 1120 at night. And by the way, he's not dead. Obviously, we're doing the show about the son killing his mom and his stepfather. But I wanted to go back to the house now. Inside that house, they find that his mother has been shot multiple times.
Yep.
There's four wounds caused by three shots. Now, one of the wounds was to her right hand.
Yes.
And I was wondering, because you've got two shots to the abdomen, one to the neck, was the wound in her right hand caused by her a defensive move, her putting her arm up?
It could be. You could also have with the abdominal wound as well. And I've had this happen, and it's kind of an odd thing to see, but it does happen. You will have they have not released the autopsy report on the case, but you can have a situation where, say, for instance, someone is turning, and I'm talking about the victim. Okay. Let's say the victim is kind of rotating at the waist, and now the shooter is obliquely oriented to them. So they're on the side. I've had cases where, in the abdomen in particular, where it's kind of flabby, you can have a round that initially enters kind of laterally, okay, goes through, exits, and re-enters the body. And you can, and this happens with some frequency. It's not like if you saw it in the morgue, you wouldn't say, wow, what a finding, because it happens more than you know. You know, people see old Western movies, and I guess even movies today, where people are shot, people many times appear to be static when they're shot. If you know that you have a weapon pointed at you and they're firing, or you sense that they're going to fire, people will flinch, they'll turn. Nobody's going to stand still most of the time to be shot. They're going to react to the sight. And can you imagine with a 357 Magnum, if she sees this thing, the muzzle on this thing is, it's going to look like, you know, you're looking down inside of a peach basket. It's that big. Of course it's not, but it's rather imposing. Well, she's going to react to that. Now, back to what you said, can she be shot through the hand? Let's say that she raises her hand to her neck, in where the palm is out. Okay. Yes, you can have a round that will go through and through. It's called a through and through wound. It would pass through the palm of the hand or through the fingers, out through the back of the hand, and then back in to the neck. That can happen as well. And those injuries are rather interesting, because let's just say, for instance, and we don't know this for a fact, but let's just say, for instance, everybody at home kind of feel the palm of your hand right now, and you can feel the bony structures within your hand, okay? Well, if you're shot through your hand, that projectile, that lead core projectile that is passing through the palm of your hand, there's a high probability it's going to strike bone. When it strikes bone, there's going to be potentially deformation to the round. So when it exits out of the hand, it enters the hand, strikes bone, there's a wound track through the hand, exits, the bullet is not going to be pristine, okay? When it comes out, it's going to be oddly shaped, and you'll get kind of like in the neck, you'll get these kind of weird looking injuries where you have, and it's what it's referred to as, we use a term for it, it's called an intermediate target. And it doesn't have to be a body part. Like if somebody's shot through a wall, or shot through a piece of glass, or shot through the door of a car, the bullet is changed forever. The projectile is changed because it becomes shredded. It becomes even more jagged. So you get these really nasty looking wounds. And so if they're, and
except
you think
for
about
November 22nd, 1963 in Dallas, Texas, at Dealey Plaza, when Governor Connally was shot through the wrist and everything else. And it was a pristine bullet that landed next to his thigh on the gurney.
Exactly. And again, the pristine bullet theory. And of course it's utter nonsense.
I had to throw it in there. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you did, particularly in the wake of everything that we're seeing now. We need to do another episode, I think. Anyway,
I think you're right. All right. So,
you have this, and
right,
and then she's got multiple gunshot wounds. But she's got multiple gunshot wounds, and this is really interesting. Mr. Mayor has got one. And I got to tell you, Dave, this goes back to the old adage theory, or you know, the way we view these things. Why do you need to take a 357 Magnum and shoot this diminutive woman multiple times? Can you explain? And this is hypothetical. Can you explain that to me? Most people would look at this, I think behaviorists might look at it and say, well, this borders on overkill. It borders on overkill.
And that's where, Joe, as I was looking at this, in my mind, because, you know, you started off the show talking about being around bodies, you know, and over a period of time, you can see different types of bodies in different stages of decomp, what have you.
Yeah.
When I do stories even now, I still have that hope when a child does something or when a parent does something that the victim doesn't know. That the victim, in the case of Mr. Mayor, I'm thinking, okay, he was shot in the back of the head with the 357 Magnum. I'm hoping it was by surprise, that he never knew it was coming. Boom, he's gone.
Yeah.
I'm guessing if that were to happen, now the mom knows something bad is happening and she's coming, and that's why she gets shot multiple times.
And she's in a different area of the house,
right,
too.
In the hallway.
Yeah.
And then my thing is, I hate to think that the last thing this mother knew was that her son was doing this horrific thing,
right,
allegedly. But I want to go quickly to when the police arrived, and we have both the bodies were covered with different things, and you covered how that has to be unlayered. When the bodies are taken out of the home, are they taken up as a lump with the blankets, covers, or whatever is on them, or are those removed and the bodies are placed in a bag? How are they transported so they don't lose all the possible forensic evidence in there?
I got to tell you, in a case like this where you've got loose blankets, if it were me, I would document, let's just take mom's body. I would document her body so well, or the location where she is seen, okay, or viewed here at site. I would go into painstaking detail about every aspect of this. And because I don't want to lose anything or transfer anything to the outer layers of the blankets that might be contained therein, because you're going to run that risk in a body bag. I'm not going to say it's like a tumble dryer, but you can have things that are mixed up in there as the body is bouncing down the road. I would take each layer off. If it's not secured, if the perpetrator hadn't wrapped it with anything, if you're talking about wrapping a body that's cocooned in blankets, that's a different story. But if you've got them just laying, I'm going to take up each individual blanket one by one, put it in a separate paper container, seal it up, label it, and it's going to go in individually. It's not going to accompany the body. It's going to go with the crime scene tech back to their repository so it can make it out to the state crime lab. And I'm talking about layer. If I've got, look, and I don't know that this is the case, but let's just say, I'll pick an arbitrary number. Let's just say we've got 12 layers. You're getting 12 bags from me. Okay. You're getting 12 bags. Yeah. And I want each one of them to be examined. And here's one more thing that you got to think about. Was she covered in blankets and then shot? Or was she shot and then covered in blankets? And you say, well, God, that's kind of obvious. No, there's nothing obvious in death investigation. You know, your assumption, you have to consider all possibilities, and it gets very complex. I mean, can you imagine how much more complex this would be if he, I don't know, some weird, bizarre set of circumstances happened and he tackles mom, he puts blankets all on the top of her because he's seen a movie that thinks it's going to muffle the sound. He starts firing through multiple layers of blankets into her body. Well, that's even going to make the rounds more deformed. You're going to get fiber evidence. I've actually recovered bullets, projectiles from bodies, Dave, that had bits of fiber twisted up in jagged edges of the projectile that are embedded in the body, because it passed through, again, one of these intermediate targets, went into the body, and then it's there. I found wood embedded in bodies that, you know, where you've got like particle board, where you've got rounds that pass through particle board, and that kind of splinters and goes into a body. There's all manner of things, and it tells a very specific story about this. But Dave, I'd be very curious to understand. I think with the stepfather in particular, you had mentioned that you were hoping that he didn't see it coming. I hope that he didn't either, to be honest with you. But one of the things they would have to figure out with him, I think particularly, this is kind of curious. This sounds like a classic execution style killing. I'd like to know if they were able to determine a range of fire, if the muzzle was placed directly against the back of his head. This kid just walked up, the guy, you said he's in his office, maybe he was seated in a chair, he didn't know it was coming, walks up behind him, pops him, you know, right in the head. Or did he say, gee, stepdad, you know, I'd really like to handle that new 357 Magnum that you bought. Can I see it? And he hands it over to him, and the thing's loaded, and he looks at him and shoots him in the face. You know, because you say, or shoots him in the head while he's not suspecting it. You know, it can go either number of ways. You know, how did the kid know that the weapon was in the house? How did he get access to it? Okay. Then with mom, where were her wounds oriented, and what range of fire would there be? Because you're going to have, with 357 Magnum in particular, it's a Magnum round. So you're talking about a lot of propellant, Dave, and you will have stippling, you know, that where this gets embedded into the skin, and onto the clothing. We can determine range of fire based upon how far out it's spread on the remains or on the clothing. And that gives us an idea. And all of a sudden, you know, the focus on the story is becoming a little bit tighter now. You know, once you kind of establish the physical relationship between the muzzle of that weapon being held allegedly by a son and the recipients of the rounds that, you know, whose bodies that the rounds were fired into.
You know, when they actually were able to get to the son,
yeah.
I mentioned earlier, he was 800 plus miles away.
Yeah.
They used a number of different things, surveillance cameras, cell phones. When they did track him, the son, they found him, like I said, you found the bodies early in the day, you know, with calls. Yeah, and this is now 12 hours later, and they already got him, you know, 800 plus miles away.
Right.
They were able to track this, his behavior, using his parents' credit cards and things like that, starting on February 12th. All the way through the 28th, the gun, the 357 Magnum, matching the description of Donald Mayer's gun that he had just bought, is found in the floorboard of the, well, when they caught Nicky driving the VW Atlas owned by his stepfather, that's who they caught him driving his car. And the 357 Magnum is on the floorboard along with unspent and spent shell casings. You got bullets in there and spent shells. Do you think he picked them up in the house and left with them? I don't know.
No, because 357 Magnum's a revolver.
Okay.
So they're
going to be in the gun.
Oh, yeah. And he probably dumped them, which when you open up the gate on a revolver and the cylinder spins out because you press it out, there's an ejection rod on the thing. So you press the ejection rod and all of those spent round, well, any round that's in there, it doesn't matter if it's live or spent, are going to drop out. Now, here's the interesting thing. Can we go back to the mom just one second? How many injuries did you say that she had sustained? And they think
three gunshot wounds, four injuries.
Okay, so she's got three gunshot wounds, four injuries. Mr. Mayer has got a single gunshot wound. Okay, so 357 Magnums, these revolvers can come in a configuration to hold five rounds in cylinder or six. Now, just so we all understand, because I know I'm going to get blowback on this, there is a semi-automatic 357 out there. It does exist, but the lion's share of people do not possess these. Most of these platforms with 357 Magnums are revolvers. So if it's a semi-automatic, like you had said, you know, did he pick up the rounds at the house or the spent casings? Then yeah, if it's a semi-automatic. But my suspicion is that traditionally the 357 Magnum is something that you have in a revolver configuration. And I actually owned one or was issued one at one point in time years ago that was a Colt Lawman. I loved that weapon. It was a snub nose weapon, and it was only five shots. The cylinder only held five rounds. But you can have the more robust, and for years, there were some cops that still carry 38 specials. But you had those that actually opted for a 357 Magnum. This is before the days of police officers being issued semi-automatic handguns, you know, with the Berettas and the Glocks and, you know, every SIGs and all these other brands that are out there now. There were some police officers that preferred the 357 because they knew that the energy they were going to put on target if they had to use this thing was going to be substantially more significant than the 38 special. All right. They knew that it would have more power to it. That's originally, you know, everything that we do in firearms, and this is kind of interesting, most of in the civilian world, even in policing, has its origins in the military. You go all the way back to the turn of the 20th century from the late 1800s before the invention of the 1911 45 caliber sidearm that our military carried. Our officers and NCOs used to carry 38 specials, and those rounds were insufficient. We'll put it to you that way. That's why they, you know, when they could get up to a 45 caliber semi-automatic handgun, they went to it because, again, it was like, you know, it's getting hit with a 45, which is even more robust than 357 Magnum, is like getting hit with a sledgehammer.
So that's what we've got. Got that kid using that on his stepdad in the back of the head. All right, but let me go back to something else, Joe, because the bodies were so decomposed that they could not be identified. Now, how is that in the space of 2 weeks' time inside of a home out of the elements? How is that a thing? I would have thought that, granted, I understand odor. I understand that in decomposition, but talking about two bodies inside of a home decomposing at such a rate that they could not be identified in 2 weeks' time.
Well, we're talking about Wisconsin. We're talking about the wintertime. And guess what you got going on in the house? You're running the heat, baby. And so there's constant heat. And for everyone that has to fight this fight, that lives in areas where it turns off cold, you know, our friends down in Florida might not have to deal with this too much, but where it's always having to fight that fight, that heater is always competing with the external temperature. And, you know, it's, you know, if you've got a drafty house or whatever, thermostat is going to indicate that, you know, you've got the temperature is decreasing, so it's going to kick back on. So it's always in a state of having warmth. And also here's the thing, you know, the heat in a house varies from location to location. I mean, that kind of makes sense, but let's just say you're talking about mom's body being in the hallway where she's laying next to a vent. And on top of that, she's got these layers of fabric that are lying on top of her. That's going to further exacerbate. There are actually cases out there, Dave, where you will have people that have been homicide victims in homes where, because of the location within the structure, one body decomposes quicker than the other body because of the relative position to like heating vents or cooling. It can work conversely as well. We saw this, not exactly the same thing, but we saw with Gene Hackman, which you and I have talked about extensively, where Betsy's body was found. They talked about her being mummified, but, you know, Mr. Hackman had probably walked through that house for 5 days, I think, you know, before he finally succumbed to, you know, and of course he had advanced Alzheimer's. But yeah, you think about just even the variation in the location within a structure can impact the rate at which bodies decompose. The fact that this kid stayed in this house for as long as he did, the fact that he allegedly tried to feign the still living existence of his parents through text messages and these sorts of things, the fact that he ran up almost $10,000 in the use of credit cards and debit cards, and the fact that he stole that car and ran off with it. There's more to be revealed in this case, I can tell you that. But when you've got a young man who's 17 years old, who allegedly executes both of his parents and indwells a house with their rotting corpses for this long, these still waters run very, very deep. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags.